Hi, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Hi, everybody. My name's Dave Thompson. I am the CTO at the Sprightly Institute, and today we're going to be talking about functional reactive programming with propagators. Words you may or may not understand. Don't worry, I will explain them. But quickly, about Sprightly, Christine already explained, but working on the next generation of decentralized technology, so I probably won't belabor the point since Christine was just here. So let's get right into it. Before we get to the functional aspect, let's just talk about reactive programming. Who knows what it is or has used a library for reactive programming? Okay, a little over half of the room, I'd say. Okay, for those that don't know, the way I like to describe it is it's a way to work with time-varying values without entering callback hell. So without having to do like procedural event-driven continuation passing style programming. So it's usually as a declarative abstraction on top of an event loop. So like in the web browser, you know, you have events for keyboard input, mouse input, etc. Rather than writing event callbacks, you have some declarative way to do this. Graphical user interfaces are kind of where this type of programming seems to be used the most. And probably if I say the word React, does everyone know what React is? Like, show of hands. Okay, basically every, okay, yeah. So React really mainstreamed reactive programming for like the web development community at large. So here's an example, probably the simplest example from the React documentation. It's just a button, and then every time you click it, the click increments. So this is reactive, but it's not functional. So we have a mutation right there. We have some kind of state thing, and you when a click event happens, the onClick handler fires, and then we increment the count. So that's reactive, but it's not functional. So I want to talk about the functional side. At its simplest, we just take reactive programming and then we use more pure functions and we have functional reactive programming. However, it's really hard to define FRP without probably making somebody mad because it's not a super well-defined term and there seems to be contention about like what it really means. There's many forms. There's a continuous FRP, discrete FRP, push-based, pull-based, hybrid push-pull-based. But for this talk, I'm just going to say that discrete push-based FRP seems to be the most practical thing for dealing with things like just the event loops that we're typically used to. So I'm going to go with that. And this is not a new idea. This is a paper from ICFP, 1997, called Functional Reactive Animation, and I believe this is the origin of the term functional reactive programming. I believe this was implemented in Haskell way back when. And I believe the authors of this paper would probably be mad about the definition of FRP that I just told you. So hopefully they're not ever going to see this. Unlike React, which is immensely popular, FRP has not had the same success of React likes. And I like to think of this blog post from the Elm language, if anyone's familiar with Elm. It was like a Haskell-like that ran in the compiled to JavaScript, ran in web browsers. It's still around. But it had a big moment in like the early to mid 2010s, and it went all in on FRP at the beginning. And then in 2016, they wrote this. The creator Evan wrote a farewell to FRP, and I kind of like to me this is kind of like the death knell of FRP as like an idea that was gaining like it was gathering steam, and then I feel like it kind of died here. But the FRP bug has been in my brain for longer than this, and it's never really left. I keep being interested in it. And so never mind all that stuff, all these projects tried and failed. Let's look at this with Scheme. So here's a really wonderful, amazing demo. It's very complicated. And you see, it's the same thing as in the React code that I showed you. A little button, I click, and it increments. Oh, great, wow. That's amazing. Okay, talk over. What I'm gonna show is I'll show you some Scheme code. So don't worry too much about understanding this, but I want to show that it's declarative and functional in the sense that you're not going to see a set bang here or any kind of mutation. We have this, I'm calling them cells. They hold time-varying values. This one's going to hold click notifications. Concepts that we're used to in functional programming or like doing operations on lists map pretty well. So we're going to fold, and it's a fold not over a list, but over time. We're going to take in the click cell. We're going to have an initial value of 0 because initially the user hasn't clicked the button at all. And every time an event comes in, we're going to modify that counter. We're going to increment it. And then good thing Christine was just talking about SXML. This is the next SXML template. And what we do is we have an onClick handler here. And we got this unquote thing. We turn this click cell, we make a listener for it. So every time a click event comes in, we update our little FRP cell. And then we splat in the count. And so this is this refers to the value of the cell, and the engine behind all this just ensures that the UI is updated. And so this presentation that I've been showing you is running in the web browser, is running a Scheme program. This is the source code for the slide you just saw. So this is a WebAssembly program that is a Scheme program compiled to WebAssembly running these slides. So this is the actual code of the demo I just showed you. So we'll go back to the presentation. I think I have to click off of here. OK. So I can't talk about FRP without talking about glitches. Can't really talk about reactive programming in general without talking about glitches. The most important job of any reactive library or framework is to avoid glitches. And a glitch is usually a brief, small, like a tiny moment of time where a time-varying value gets computed with a mix of stale and fresh data. And it often becomes user visible, and it's like a flash of like something weird, and it comes and it goes, but it leads to like a janky user experience, and we don't want this. So I'm going to try to walk through this little thing. I can explain glitches with just a graph of four nodes. So right here, it's just a very simple data flow graph. A is the root. Numbers enter here. I'm just going to be working with integers. The B cell gets anytime A changes, we take A times 2, we put it in B. Take A plus 1, put it in C. And then D depends on both B and C, and we just take the difference. And so at the start, the cells contain nothing. Well, we have to bootstrap our graph, so somehow we insert the number 2, and that kicks off reactivity. So it flows to B, and we double it, so we get 4. We add 1, we get 3, and then finally we take the difference, and we get 1. Great, all looks well. However, let's take another approach to it, another data flow path. So we come in at the root again, bootstrap. We update this value to 3. We propagate to node B. We double it. We get 6. But instead of going to node C, we go to node D. Node D depends on B and C. So we take the difference and we get 3. But that's wrong, because the value here is 3. So what we really want is the value 2. But because this cell refreshed before this one, we have a glitch. And so it eventually, after 2 more steps, converges to the correct value. But we have a moment that's probably going to annoy a user somewhere in the interface where the value is wrong. So this is no good. How do we avoid glitches? Reactive libraries typically do something like a topological sort. So D is below nodes B and C in the graph. So B and C should be refreshed first, and then D. And then we ensure that D is always computed with fresh values. But we have a restriction once we add that property. The node graph must be acyclic. Therefore, as a consequence, only a subset of possible interfaces that we can implement with event callbacks are now expressible with reactive programming or functional reactive programming. So turns out we will be able to remove this restriction, but I want to show an example. So this is a color picker diagram. Here we have the RGB values for representing color that way, and then on the other side we have hue saturation value sliders. And what we would like to have happen is anytime you manipulate one of these sliders, the sliders over here change. So we convert RGB to HSV and update the sliders accordingly. And when you change any of the HSV values, we convert HSV to RGB and update these. So there's circularity there, like you see in the middle. And so we can't express that with acyclic reactivity. But acyclic reactivity is the norm. And it's what is popular, and it seems like what's going to continue to be used in the industry at large. This is a screenshot of a TC39 proposal, the standards group responsible for changes to JavaScript. They're working on something called Signals. And it says right in it, it's a proposal for one-way data flow in JavaScript. There's so many reactive libraries in JavaScript. They're trying to bring an API to JavaScript itself. So that's the state of the art there. But I wouldn't be up here if I thought cyclic reactivity was impossible. It's very possible, and the secret ingredient is propagators. Has anyone heard of propagators? Okay, much smaller group of people than knew about reactivity in general. Okay, so I want to introduce you to one of my favorite PhD dissertations, which I feel is a weird thing to say, because who has a list of their favorite ones? Normally, they're so dense, they're hard to read. I got to trust me on this. This one isn't. This is by Alexei Raudul, who is a PhD student at MIT. This is from 2009. Propagation Networks, a Flexible and Expressive Substrate for Computation. It is a fantastic read. I'm going to cover just a little tiny bit of that paper that talks about FRP and no more, but I really recommend if any of this piques your interest, go there. Everything I'm about to tell you is derived from it. So what the hell are propagators? This is a lot of text. I'll just read the bold part. They're autonomous, independent machines interconnected by shared cells through which they communicate. And this is straight out of Gerald Sussman's, and I'm forgetting the co-author right now, but Software Design for Flexibility from 2021. If you liked SICP and you want something similar to it that's you know, not from the 80s with additional more advanced topics, check that book out, MIT Press. Okay, so in real simple terms, cells are nodes, but notably they contain partial information. This is Alexei Raudul's key insight in his dissertation. You can, including partial information being nothing. So there's initially a cell contains nothing, and over time it accumulates information. And this can get particularly complicated. A lot of propagator lore and research goes into like AI systems and like truth maintenance systems and stuff. I'm going to talk about something much simpler, but it can get pretty crazy. And the propagators you can just think of as the edges. They're the things that take values from some input cells, do some computation, and then write them to one or more output cells. But notably, this relationship between cells can be one-to-one, can be one-to-many, it can be many-to-many. There's no, you know, there's no restriction on that. And also, there's no restriction on when propagators, like, fire and when they refresh themselves. So propagator flow is dumb, and it's dumb on purpose. It's meant to be very easy to implement. And so propagator networks, by definition, they have no order of evaluation, and they have no directionality restrictions. So if we want to build reactivity on propagators, we can't do topological sort. So we have to do something else. So we have a problem. If we don't solve the problem, we're going to have glitches, and we're going to have a terrible reactive system. As is often the case, there's a lot of things in computer science where you start with some kind of unordered system and you put order on top of it. Well, propagators are no different. Alexei Raudul explained that using an approach that really resembles logical timestamps in a distributed system, if you're familiar with logical clocks, Lamport timestamps, vector clocks, very similar concept. What we want to do is when we bootstrap our nodes, when data comes into it from the outside world somewhere, we want to make sure that each piece of data is tagged with some kind of unique identifier for each piece of data, and then some kind of logical timestamp that's increasing monotonically with each change. And so as values accumulate and flow through the graph, you'll get many such pairs, and these pairs form a vector clock. And with that, you can tell if the data that you're about to use is fresh or not. We can halt propagation when a propagator fires and it discovers that its inputs have differing timestamps for the same identifier. If one says that the time was 1 when this value came in and the other was 2, that's conflicting. We have old and new mixed together. We should stop right there. We need to wait in order to actually do the transformation that we want to do, so we halt. And that enables circularity without infinite loops. And so the trade-off here is that there is a bit of redundant computation because a propagator may fire when it can't actually do anything yet, and it has to stop, and it has to know that. So versus topological sort, you kind of visit each node, and you know it's ready to go. But the total amount of redundant computation is actually quite minimal. And so without any ordering guarantees, a much simpler substrate, much simpler infrastructure, we can still get the same properties that we want. Values that converge without glitches. And so my definition of FRP on propagators is that it's the propagation of ephemeral values. Ephemeral values are things that change over time. And so in my prototype implementation, there is a record type in Scheme is just called ephemeral. It's a box that has any arbitrary value. And then on the side, it has a set of sources. It's the vector clock. It has all the information from whence that value came. You know, it's derived from these identifiers at these particular points in logical time. And that is enough to get what we need. I want to make a quick note. I mentioned this earlier, but it's not just, I showed a fold earlier, but pretty much any list processing idiom translates really well to FRP. You're just not mapping over a set of pairs, you're mapping over time. So map, fold, filter, you get the idea. All these things, you know, map pretty naturally. So as a functional programmer or a scheme programmer, list programmer that's used to these things, I think you can get with it pretty quick. So let's go back to the color picker. You know, this, I showed this graph earlier, and I wouldn't show it if we couldn't do it. And here it is. So this is running in the slide. This is actually code that's using propagators running in the Hoot scheme interpreter, which has been compiled to WebAssembly and running in the browser here. So you see, as I adjust the sliders in the RGB, the HSV side changes, and we have the little color swatch up there to tell you what it is, and the hex code if you want to copy it out into some other application. And here I am changing hue, saturation, and value, and the RGB sliders go. So yeah, it works, and don't just take my word for it. I mean, I guess you have to also take my word that this is real code that runs, and I didn't just do smoke and mirrors on you. But this is kind of, I'm going to have a hard time with the resolution of this fitting it in a single page. But just to show you, I've been working on some syntax that's not very good right now to define recursive graphs of nodes. And so here are the values that become our sliders. We have the RGB group, and as RGB, and then HSV group, H, S, and V. One thing I haven't talked about is what the heck is this group? Turns out that so R, G, and B, those are three facets of the same object. Like they compose together to form an RGB expression of color. And so what we want is that all three of these, they have the same identifier, and they share the same timestamp counter. So when you change any one of those, you're changing this identifier, that becomes the RGB group. You know, it starts at 0, you change R, it goes to 1. You change B, it goes to 2. They're linked together. And that proves to be an essential part of making the propagation work. So essentially, facets of a composite object that are at the root of your reactive graph, you generally want to make sure that they are using the same logical time, and they're kind of understood as like one machine in the system. If that didn't make sense, don't worry too much about it. And then finally, my kind of work in progress terrible notation for the edges in the graph. If you've ever used the dot notation in GraphViz, it's like a kind of a lispy version of that. But I'm just saying that R, G, and B, those cells combine to write a value to the RGB cell. And RGB color is a constructor for an RGB color record. But it's bidirectional. So when RGB changes, we destructure the record, and we put the RGB values in their corresponding cells. The same thing applies to HSV, just with the HSV record and its accessors. And then the good stuff happens here. It's just this is a bidirectional expression of when HSV changes, we convert it to RGB and we write it to the RGB cell. When RGB changes, we convert it to HSV and put it in the HSV cell. So that's like the entire propagator network, really. And then all that's left to do is hook it up to a UI. And let's see if I can get it all. I can get it mostly on one screen. The top, it doesn't really matter. We have some procedures to convert an RGB color to a hex string. I'm just like splatting out some gross CSS there for the color swatch. And then again, we have, this is the slide that I just showed you. This is just a record type for these slides in the slideshow system. And another quasi quote, and so another SXML template. And then I have some helpers to do the sliders for me. But notably, There's R, G, B. I'm referring to these cells, and the rendering engine will hook things up such that it does all the callback stuff under the hood. So there's a slider, and the sliders have a value. Anytime the cell changes, it'll update the value of the DOM node for that slider. And anytime someone slides it, that value will then get placed into the cell as an updated value, and then the propagation starts. So this is how values enter the propagation graph, and the graph is bootstrapped, but it's a two-way binding. So if you're used to two-way binding from any other Web UI framework, it's the same thing, but just expressed in a different way. So yeah, that's the basics of the code, and I am close to done here. I just wanted to show you that. So future work. I cobbled this together pretty fast before FOSDEM. I wrote a blog post about this in 2024, and then I kind of just stopped doing anything with it, and I kind of refreshed it for this talk. And so I did a lot of re-implementation of things, and it's kind of a mess, but it works. But it's not optimal. There's a lot of places that are slow. So to make this actually usable from Scheme in real programs that are not just demos, I'd like to optimize the internal algorithms to make the propagation better and generate less garbage. So we run the garbage collector less frequently, which could lead to UI jank. You know, it would be a bad experience if the GC is running all the time. And I'd like to publish a library that works for both the Guile virtual machine and also on the web for Hoot. I mean, I mostly want to use this for web UIs. And then I'd like to actually test drive it in some of the demos that we do at Sprightly. We've been wanting some kind of UI framework for a while, and since we use Scheme, as Christine was saying, it's a great thing for doing all of our experimentation, but on the other hand, the flip side is that like you end up rolling your own stuff a lot of the time. So you know, I don't want to use React or Vue or anything like that. I want to use our Scheme thing. So I want to try it out there. That's really it. You know, I do all this with Sprightly. If you like what we do at all, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. You know, we can't do the work we do without help from you all. So please, Sprightly.institute/donate. If you become a recurring donor, we will shout you out on our on like every blog post we do. I check out our donations list, and I thank everybody that's got monthly donations set up in there and at our various tiers. So anyway, we greatly appreciate your support. I'm done. Thank you. Do we have time for questions? I'm like clapping for myself over here. I don't understand. Okay, let's see. I'll start here.
In your Scheme definition of the propagators, you have this arrow operator.
The question was, in my demo, I have this arrow operator. And what is that? It's a syntax literal. It's just used to separate the inputs from the outputs because the I just needed some notation to show that it's like values are flowing from the left to the right.
That's a standard Scheme.
It's not, no. So I just wrote, this is what needs development. Like I need an ergonomic, like domain-specific language for doing this. And in the very little time I had, I thought of just using what GraphViz does, and you just do a little arrow.
So you're processing this with something?
Yeah, yep. Yep, so it's I could show you the macro after. It's trash, to be honest with you. But yeah, I think it's like approximately something that you would want, but like without the arrow, it looks like this. And it's like if you're reading that, it's like how do I know that I don't know what that's doing? Like if I read it, like but with the arrow, it looks like okay, values are flowing from the left to the right. So that's just kind of the intent that I wanted to put behind the syntax. But it's just a literal in there. I think you had a question? Okay.
Still, like in this piece of code.
Yeah.
Like in this case, the propagator does it execute like each individual function? Like does it assign the value one at a time, or sort of happens like the group gets reassigned all at once? Because it's a group, right? It's like
yes. So for the groups, what happens is when a cell is updated, like say the R cell gets updated. As part of it, it looks at all the members of its group, and it calls a special thing to freshen the timestamp on it. It doesn't propagate that value from those other cells, but it does ensure that it knows about the timestamp going up. So they just have to all have the same notion of logical time. And if they do, then the propagation works. If that didn't happen, the problem becomes that there's a lot of redundant computation that happens if they're not like synced up in that way. I don't think I can explain that in a succinct way right now, but yeah. Okay. Yeah, welcome. Let's see. Oh, all the way in the back?
Yeah, thank you, Anna Dapati, and love the error syntax here. I was curious, so I specifically like the form of classic FRP from like Tonal Elliott, where there's continuous time and simple formal semantics and a distinction between behaviors and events. Yeah, where does your implementation relate to that?
Let's see. Okay, the question was about how do I even say the question? About continuous FRP semantics versus discrete semantics, I think was the core of the question. Did I get that roughly right? I think the short answer is it's not classic FRP. I have not gone the continuous route. I've gone for discrete event-based things because we're used to discrete event-based systems, and it seems like the fastest way to get something that works.
Okay.
But I'm also, I've never used a continuous FRP system, so it could be that I'm just ignorant, and I need some exposure to that to know what I could take from it. So if you have any recommendations, I would love to hear them. Yeah, thank you for your question. Yeah. Yes.
You don't use,
it's because, so the question was, why not just use the freshest value if there's a mix of the two? And in the general case, there could be many things that are not fresh about it. There could be more than one. And you're not guaranteed. You could have two stale values actually, for the same thing, and that would also result in a glitch, because maybe some third input propagated over there, so like add a fifth node to the graph and that one updated, and you still have stale data. So I think in the general case it's tough. Maybe there's an optimization. So I've just went the dumb way that I know works. Yeah. I think is that it for questions?
We can take it outside or...
Well, okay, we can hallway track it. I'm happy to answer questions outside.